For nearly 60 years, one woman's cancer cells have been used in scientific studies of everything from radiation and weightlessness to new treatments for HIV/AIDS and the flu. Every detail of these HeLa cells has been quite literally under the microscope for decades, but until recently, the life of the woman who gave them to science, Henrietta Lacks, has remained shrouded in mystery. Science writer Rebecca Skloot devoted a decade to telling Henrietta's story and how her tumor helped create an industry. The result is a new book called The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. It's published by Crown. I'm very pleased to welcome Rebecca Skloot to our show today. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What kind of cancer did the original HeLa cells come from?
It was cervical cancer.
And is that a particularly good kind of cancer cell to have to deal with? Because cancer cells are quite, I mean, melanoma has very little in common with cervical cancer or breast cancer.
Right, yeah. I often get this question of how do you use cervical cancer cells to, you know, help develop the polio vaccine or all of these things that have nothing to do with cancer, let alone cervical cancer. And yeah, it's more that they were the first ones that ever grew. So these immortal human cell lines, which are lines that grow in culture indefinitely and just never die, are used for all sorts of research because they're basically, they're sort of like little versions of a human being in a petri dish. And there is a lot about HeLa cells that is normal. So, you know, they metabolize things, they produce energy, they have little membranes that viruses go through. So scientists are able to use them to study sort of what's normal about them. But also they've been so widely studied that they are just this baseline. So scientists know how they behave and they can see when things change in them.
Is it typical for a cancer cell to be able to be kept alive for 60 years or more?
No.
So Henrietta Lacks was a unique situation?
Oh, yeah. So hers, you know, scientists had been trying to grow human cells in culture for decades and it had never worked. They would take tissues from, you know, sort of anyone who came into the hospitals for various treatments. And it is still a bit of a mystery why her cells survived when all the other cells died. And we know a few things about them, and one is that she had HPV, with this virus that causes cervical cancer, and that somehow interacted with her DNA. She also had syphilis, which can weaken your immune system and make a cancer grow much faster than usual. And there was definitely just something about her tumor. She was 30 years old when she was diagnosed, and her tumor was about the size of a nickel. And within 6 months, every organ in her body was replaced by tumor, and she died very quickly. So it grew incredibly fast in her body as well.
What led someone to take her cells out and decide to try to make them work when none others had before?
Yeah, so she went. This was at Johns Hopkins Hospital. She was an African-American woman who got, when she was diagnosed, it happened to coincide with this time in cancer research when the pap smear had just been developed and scientists were trying to figure out a way of interpreting the pap smear. So they knew that they could take samples from people's, you know, from people's cervixes and look at them under a microscope, but they didn't know what they were looking for. So there was still really widespread misdiagnosis. And so at Hopkins, which is where this was done, they were taking samples from any woman who walked into Hopkins with cervical cancer as part of that study. And George Guy, who was the head of tissue culture research at Hopkins, had been trying to grow any human cells for decades. And he was just determined to make it work. So he was constantly tweaking his methods. And I think he was just determined to find the right cells that would take off.
This is before we even knew about DNA and RNA.
Yes. Yeah. Scientists had no idea what was in those cells. Yeah.
But it was also in Baltimore, a city that had a very specific racial culture in 1951.
Yeah, so Hopkins was a segregated hospital. Henrietta went there because she was black. It was one of the few places she could get treatment. It was also a charity hospital, so she and many other people went there because they couldn't afford to get treated anywhere else, and they could get treatment for free. And, you know, when these samples were taken, they didn't ask permission. So Henrietta had no idea that they had taken this sample to begin with. And she died not knowing the tissue had grown and not knowing her cells would be used in research. And
You mentioned her medical background. How important is it to know her racial background? She had both white and black ancestors. Does that matter?
It matters, in that it's part of her story. You know, she was descended from slaves, and she grew up farming the same tobacco farm that her ancestors had been enslaved on, and you know, one of her ancestors was a white slave owner, and so it's definitely part of the story.
I was just wondering about how the whole mix, which we later mm-hmm. would see as being part of the her specific genome.
Yeah, it doesn't. That didn't. It wasn't relevant in terms of the science.
It could just as easily have been if she was
were
Chinese or.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And today we have cell lines grown from all sorts of people. I mean, her cells were the first ever grown in culture, and they're different than a lot of others. But there are now still cells from lots of people.
Well, she didn't know that they had taken her cells, and nobody thought to even suggest to her that this might be an ethical issue?
No, they didn't. And it really, they wouldn't have at the time. It was standard practice for scientists to take samples from people without their knowledge. And we didn't have the concept of informed consent as we do today. It didn't exist in the 50s.
Well, people have sued, haven't they? Because they felt that that people have made a lot of money from something that was taken from their body, and they or their ancestors received no recompense.
Absolutely. Yeah, there have been a few lawsuits where people have found out that their cells were, you know, patented without their knowledge and turned out to be worth billions of dollars. And across the board, the courts have ruled against the patients in those cases, saying that people, that you don't have property rights in your tissue once they leave your body.
Now, Henrietta Lacks had children.
Yes.
Would they have even understood this? They were tobacco farmers.
Yeah, so she had five kids when she died, and her husband had a third grade education. And they didn't know about the cells until the 70s, when scientists decided to do research on her children in order to learn more about the cells. So her husband got this phone call one day, and the way he understood it was essentially, we've got your wife. She's alive in a laboratory. We've been doing research on her for the last 25 years, and now we have to test your kids to see if they have the thing that killed her, which wasn't what the scientist said at all. But the family, her husband thought they had her in a cell, like a prison cell. That was his only reference point for the word.
He thought that they'd kept her alive and told them that she had died.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah.
So they didn't really understand the basic scientific concepts involved here.
They didn't, and the scientists didn't understand that the family didn't understand, and so the family would ask questions, and the scientists just didn't really know how to even communicate with them.
Did they ever figure it out? I know that by now they know it, but that's partly because you have interacted with them.
Yeah, so I came along in the 90s, the late 90s, and still no one had explained to them what a cell was. And it took me about a year and a half to even convince them to talk to me. They'd had such bad experiences with journalists and scientists, just white people in general. But eventually, I did sort of win their trust. And part of what we did together was that they came, you know, I took them into some labs where scientists showed them their mother's cells for the first time and really talked to them about what the cells actually were.
Getting access involved establishing some kind of relationship with her daughter, Deborah Lacks.
Yeah.
And that turned out to be more difficult than you ever imagined.
Oh, yes. Yeah, and took a very long time.
Well, you came into their modest homes from a life of middle-class privilege.
Right, and I was a white girl from the Pacific Northwest who had a completely different background in every way possible. And I was entering into a world that I didn't know much about.
And then also, isn't it the matter of explaining basic science to the family something that might come across as a bit patronizing?
It could, absolutely. But they didn't. They really wanted to know this stuff. I mean, Deborah, I've never met a person who was more determined to learn something than she was. She really knew that she didn't have the education that she needed to understand it, and she wanted it badly. And she would carry a basic dictionary around with her. And when we go into labs, she'd look up the words that scientists were saying, and when she didn't understand them. And she worked so hard to do this. She really very much appreciated people sharing information.
And what did the family get out of this? Obviously, they couldn't get any payment. Was it just the satisfaction of knowing that their mother had done something that really had affected the lives of many people since?
Well, what they've gotten out of it has evolved over the years. And, you know, her cells, in addition to all the science done on them, I mean, you mentioned this,
And we'll go over some of that in a moment.
Yeah, they were the first cells ever commercialized. So we now have this multi-billion-dollar industry buying and selling tissues and cells and gene patenting, and it started with her cells. And, you know, her family can't afford health insurance. They're just completely destitute. And they often say, if our mother was so important to medicine, why can't we go to the doctor? And so they haven't.
Call Congress.
Yeah, and they haven't really found peace with that. You know, for them, coming to terms with the story has been really about separating the cells from what happened to the family. they can now sort of look at the cells and say they're very proud of what the cells have done, and they're very religious family, and in a lot of ways that's helped them. They really believe that she was sort of brought back to life as an angel in these cells in order to cure diseases, and they're not happy about the way they were treated along the way, but they are able to separate out that from their feeling about the cells.
My guest is Rebecca Skloot, S-K-L-O-O-T. Her book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, is published by Crown. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Rebecca Skloot, who's a science reporter. Her book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, is published by Crown. Haven't attitudes changed about the whole matter of cell cultures? I'm sure that in the early days, this sort of thing sounded like what the Nazi scientists did with experiments on humans.
Yeah, they're particularly in the sort of early 1900s, when scientists were first trying to grow these cells, there were a few sort of misfires where scientists said, "We've grown immortal cells," and there was this flurry of press coverage, and the scientist who was doing that was actually a eugenicist, someone who had hoped to grow these cells and eventually organs in order to sort of grant life to the people he thought deserved it, while eliminating the rest of them. And so, yeah, cell culture has had this history of a bit of fear surrounding it.
Was the Lacks family aware of the infamous Tuskegee experiments involving venereal disease?
Yeah, absolutely. And part of the reason why the story of Henrietta Lacks was so sort of terrifying to them is that when they got that phone call saying, you know, "We've got her cells alive in a lab," and they thought maybe they had her in a lab, that was literally just months after the news hit about the Tuskegee studies. So there had been just press coverage all over about black people being used in research without their consent, men with syphilis not being treated in order to be studied. So they, and a lot of other people, thought, oh, so scientists didn't treat her cancer so that these cells would grow, and this is another Tuskegee. So it was very much a part of that history.
And more recently, we've had the whole debate over stem cell research.
Yeah, and just cell culture in general. I mean, I think there's the more that we are able to learn from these cells and DNA, and the more that they become valuable as products, the more people are becoming aware of them and sort of talking about the ethical issues around them.
I'm still stunned that the courts think that we don't own our own cells.
Yeah, they don't. And a lot of that is because of a fear that giving ownership to people would inhibit science. So the previous court cases...
Well, somebody's making money.
Well, right, exactly. And there's actually a court case right now going on where a large group of scientists are suing Myriad Genetics over a patent saying that essentially the patenting in general is interfering with science. So, yeah.
Has anybody made a lot of money from the HeLa cells?
Oh, sure. You can trace some of our biggest biotech corporations back to this one company that started off selling HeLa cells. And you can go online and buy a vial of HeLa cells for $200 and products made using them for anywhere up to about $10,000 a vial.
Hasn't somebody suggested that the HeLa cells have become a thing in themselves?
Yeah, they did in the 90s. A scientist,
their own species?
Right. He proposed that because HeLa cells, when you grow cells in culture, they evolve and change. And, you know, cells growing in one guy's lab do something completely different than in someone else's lab. And so there are now lines of HeLa cells. They're all different from each other. And, you know, one scientist proposed that they were their own species now. And
well, they're also dependent on scientific research to survive.
Absolutely, yeah.
But I heard that some have even traveled through the air and contaminated other cell cultures.
Yes, absolutely. This is, and it's still...
This is a powerful cell.
Yes, it is. And this is an ongoing problem, actually. The HeLa cell contamination still happens. So if HeLa cells, any cells really, can float on dust particles in the air, they can travel on unwashed hands. If you pipette cells out of one dish and move them to another and then reuse that, you'll transfer HeLa cells. And HeLa cells grow so much more aggressively than a lot of other cells and faster that they just take over any dish they land in, which has caused over the years millions of dollars in damage.
This is not just a science book. You talk about your personal experiences with the family. You talk about the cells being brought to other parts of the world. And a number of coincidences happen while you're researching the book. For example, something happened while you were in the Baltimore Holiday Inn.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, so in, I was at the Holiday Inn looking out the window at this, they had a famous sort of Bromaseltzer clock in a big tower clock. And I was reading the first article ever written about Henry Alex's family by in the Rolling Stone by a reporter who tracked them down in the 70s. And I was sitting there reading it. And, you know, it said in the story, I'm sitting here in my Holiday Inn in Baltimore looking out the window at the Bromaseltzer clock trying to find the family, which was exactly what I was doing. And there was a lot of that almost sort of Twilight Zone feeling stuff that happened.
Well, Deborah Lax felt that there was some deep explanation for why you became interested in her mother.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Deborah, once we got to a point where she trusted me and we were sort of, I was working on the book, she very much believed that Henrietta had chosen me at a certain point and had been essentially working me like a puppet my whole life. You know, go over here and get a degree in science, then go over here and study writing. And everything that happened in my life for Deborah had some sort of an explanation in what Henrietta wanted.
But you're not religious, and the Laxes are deeply religious. Did that bother them?
It didn't bother them. And at first it bothered me more than it did them. I was raised not religious at all, and I was actually uncomfortable with, you know, being involved with, in a family who was, you know, talked about the Bible a lot, and I was completely out of place and didn't know how to talk to them about religion. And, you know, doing this book, I read the Bible for the first time, and I went into churches for the first time.
And you witnessed faith healing. An exorcism.
Yes, a sort of faith healing, a laying on of hands, and, you know, in something that really did sort of resemble an exorcism of, you know, someone trying to remove the cells from Deborah and put them into me. And
were they giving spiritual explanations for the power of the HeLa cells?
Absolutely. Part of understanding the family for me was understanding their religion and the way that religion played a role in all this. And they absolutely believe that she is an angel brought back to life in these cells, and that the cells have the power to heal and also cause some problems if she makes you mad. That to them is the explanation for the contamination problem that happened, is that Henrietta got mad at the scientists. And they, you know, Deborah would often say, you don't make Henrietta mad because she'll sick HeLa on you and she'll mess up your lab. So, yeah, for them, she is very much still alive in these cells.
And I'm assuming in this book as well, how have they reacted to the publication of this book?
It's been pretty amazing to watch. There are different generations of Laxes now. You know, there's grandkids, great-grandkids, great-great-grandkids. And they've all been reading it. Henrietta's grandkids have been reading it out loud to their parents, her children. And I think it's been a really wonderful thing for them in some ways, because her grandkids were another generation of people who no one talked about Henrietta after she died. No one talked about what happened to her kids. So her grandkids really didn't know what Henrietta had contributed to science or what had happened to their parents to make them so upset. So they now understand their family in a very different way, and they all get a sort of scope of what Henrietta cells contributed. And for the grandchildren, great-grandchildren, you know, for them, they read this and they feel very bad for what their parents went through, but they also read it and go, our grandmother was a rock star. You know, she did such amazing stuff for science, and they really have embraced the science side of the story in a way that their parents couldn't, because they don't have the same pain that their parents had associated with it.
You say in the book that you plan to set up a scholarship fund for her descendants as well, if this book makes any money.
Yeah, so when I first started working on the book, I had this, you know, I knew that I was one in a long line of people who'd come to the family wanting something from them and that I could potentially benefit. I mean, I was a graduate student at the time. I couldn't even really conceive of the fact that the book might get published. But I set up a foundation. It's called the Henrietta Lacks Foundation, and some of the proceeds from the book are going in there, and people can donate. And it's many things, I hope, you know, one of them being a scholarship fund for the family and also hopefully helping her kids get some health insurance.
A listener, Sophia in Yonkers, left a comment on our show page. She writes, I heard another interview which mentioned that a researcher had discussed the use of her cells for research with Henrietta. Mm-hmm. Is there any truth to that claim?
Yeah, there's. I talk about that in the book. There's this, I talked to everyone who knew George Guy, who I could find, I talked to, and I would always try to find out, did he ever have contact with her? And everyone said no, he had never met her, he didn't know anything about her. But there was this one scientist who, I didn't even actually ask her the question, she just sort of volunteered the information at one point. She said, oh, I remember he told me that not long before she died, he went to her hospital bed and he said, your cells are going to live forever and you're going to be immortal and you're going to help millions of people, and that she said that she was very happy to hear that. You know, and I put it in the book in that context, saying the only person who ever said it was her. And you know, and it's in line with George Guy's personality that he would have done it. I believe it could have happened.
But we'll never know.
Right. It's also in line with her personality that she would have thought it was great. She definitely wouldn't have understood it. She wouldn't have known what he was saying. And at that point, she was also so heavily medicated that she wouldn't have been able to comprehend it.
Your father, Floyd Scoot, has written extensively about medical experiences that he has suffered through. But isn't he also helping you put together the book tour?
Yeah.
His having memory problems?
Yeah, and he's definitely, you know, he got a virus in the 80s that caused some pretty severe brain damage, and he has sort of evolved in a way that he learned a way to live with it and has really gotten to a point where he is also a writer, and he sort of relearned how to write with his brain damage, and he's we joke and we call him my famously brain damaged father, but he's actually, you know, he's able to do a lot of the stuff mostly because he has tools, you know, he sort of has developed methods for, you know, note cards for reminding him of things. So when I decided that I wanted to go on this book tour and that I was going to have to organize it myself, my dad was the calendar and map guy. So I would just contact people about places I wanted to go, and then I would send him information and say, okay, find me the date that makes sense geographically so I'm not zigzagging all over the country. And so which is very appropriate. He's a very protective father. So for him, this was great. So he was like, okay, I'll make sure, and I'll schedule in days for rest, which, of course, didn't really happen. But
was his experience one of the reasons you became interested in writing about science?
I think so. It's not something that consciously did, but now thinking back on it, you know, the year that he got sick was 1988, which was the same year that I first learned about the HeLa cells. I was 16. And I learned about
cells. You've been with them all these years?
Yes.
They're living longer in you than they are in the Petri dish.
That's right. It's true. I first learned about the cells in this basic biology class, and I heard about them. And the first question I asked, so my teacher said, there are these cells. They've been alive all this time. And he said, they came from this woman, Henrietta Lacks, and she was black. And I went up to him after class and said, well, what else do we know about her? And does she have any kids? And what did they think about all this? And my father at that time was actually involved in a drug study, so he was a subject in research. And I, because I was 16 and just gotten my license, I would drive him to the hospital four or five times a week to get these infusions of this experimental drug. And so I was enmeshed in this world of research on my father. And so I think that's why I was very aware. The first questions I asked were, well, what do her kids think?
Rebecca Skloot, Skloot, her book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. It's published by Crown. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.